So we're particularly appreciative of your interest in the National Biosurveillance Strategy for Human Health and your willingness to, by being here, to contribute to the development of that strategy. The initial 15 minutes or so will be really background on HSPD-21 and how it's being implemented by the Department of Health and Human Services and the federal government through our work being led or brokered by CDC. And then to give you more detail on the assessment, you know, a two-month assessment on the current capabilities, and Pam Diaz stepping in for Ann Fleischauer, who was leading much of that work during the initial 4 months of our activity. But as Curtis pointed out, we want to spend at least, if not more than half, of the conversation about these some of the specific priority areas. And we'll start with one, and if we spend the whole time talking about that one, we'll go no further, and we'll look for other opportunities to talk about the other ones at a later time. So this work is really the culmination of many activities, including the Pandemic and All Hazards Preparedness Act, including state and local engagement and interest in how we are coordinating and showing national leadership around biosurveillance activities, and including, and not the least of which, the Homeland Security Presidential Directive Number 21. Within that directive, there is a specific call on HHS to establish a national biosurveillance system for human health. I've done the underlining here, but that's the label that you saw on the title of this presentation. This system for human health should have international connectivity where appropriate and should be predicated on state, regional, and community level capabilities and create a network system to allow for two-way information flow between and among federal, state, and local public health authorities and clinical health care providers. So the PD-21 laid out a charge, a challenge to the federal government and specifically to HHS. HHS, in conversations with the director of CDC, agreed that CDC should take the federal lead role in this. And Dr. Gerberding then stood up a biosurveillance coordination unit to be that broker within CDC, the agency, but also across the federal government, and to reach out to these federal, state, local public health authorities and clinical health care providers to lay out a strategy. Biosurveillance for human health is challenging to define. It's not defined by a system. It's not defined by specific conditions under surveillance. It's not even defined by surveillance per se. And it's an evolving definition. I think Pam will offer the working definition that was used in the collection of information about our current capabilities. But we're currently using this definition, which is open to evolution as we try to put some boundaries around what is biosurveillance and what is not biosurveillance. We look at it as the collection, analysis, interpretation, and reporting of timely health-related information for public health action. That has very much a surveillance, a public health surveillance tone to it, but it's also the language used in the PD, in the presidential directive. Despite the term bio, or the suffix bio at the beginning of biosurveillance, it is intended to be all hazards. Not just all conditions, but also threats and exposures, not just specific diseases and human health conditions. It's also not just surveillance. It's really, we look at it as the entire information supply chain for emergency response. Surveillance and investigation, which includes the validation and initial investigation to inform response actions. And ultimately, it's to serve our ability to control acute health events of national interest through early detection and characterization for intervention. So the goals of national biosurveillance capability for human health include timely or comprehensive, all-source, analyzed, and accessible information to support federal decision-making, but it's premised on increased capability of state and local government for early warning, rapid characterization, and overall situational awareness of public health events of national concern. It's premised also on improved information flows that are multidirectional, near real-time, and as much as possible relevant to all users, and improved recognition and characterization of urgent health threats based on integration of all relevant information. So a tall order here, not one that necessarily inherently constrains biosurveillance, but it is focused more on the timely information that we need and the integrated collection and use of information to better characterize and respond to acute health threats. The approach of the Biosurveillance Coordination Unit is really to create some opportunities for innovation. A wise CEO has stated that you have to have a set of necessary conditions for innovation to occur. To start with, you have to listen to people, and that's really been the forum that we've created to, in the first now 8 months of 7 months of working on development of this national strategy, to create a number of working groups and forums within which we can hear user perspectives and stakeholder perspectives and try to bring them together and then feed them back to these stakeholders to assure that we're putting forward appropriate, feasible strategy for enhancing our national capability. So we have a U.S. government, a federal interagency work group that's convened by HHS and chaired by CDC. We have a small state, local, tribal, territorial partner work group that includes both a public health perspective and some clinical perspective. We have two different groups, a leadership group within CDC and a subject matter expert group within CDC on biosurveillance-related programs and activities. And as of 2 weeks ago, we convened the first meeting of the National Biosurveillance Advisory Subcommittee, which is another part of the PD calls for a FACA, basically, an independent external body to inform the federal government as to how to implement and to improve, improve our national capability. And we'll talk more about that. Some of the representation of federal work groups, some of the representation of organizations. The advisory subcommittee has much broader representation than here. These are just not as updated slides yet. So accomplishments of this activity to date. We've held weekly or biweekly meetings of these four work groups that laid out, not the advisory subcommittee. Since late January, we've coordinated and sponsored 6 one-day meetings to build consensus on some of the content in the national strategy. We developed and delivered a draft, an initial draft of the National Biosurveillance Strategy to the CDC director according to her directive by May 30th, and then the subsequent week out to now over 400 stakeholders and organizations in early June of this year. And as I mentioned earlier, we convened the National Biosurveillance Advisory Subcommittee to provide advice to the federal government. Still a lot more work to do, and we can talk more about that if you have questions and interest in that regard. So when we undertook the planning activity, we looked at the PD is having two primary tasks. One is have a system, and our approach to having a system was to lay out a strategy first, to take a look at what the user needs were for this system and a broad range of users and stakeholders. Two, to look at what our current capability is to meet those user needs. And then three, lay out some strategic directions, some opportunities, unique opportunities to enhance our capability. And as you can imagine, in 3 to 4 months of doing this work, we did a lot of listening, but there wasn't a whole lot of time to do scientific, rigorous literature and other pilot studies to gather this information. So what you see in this version is really a high-level characterization of the user requirements and of the current capability. Those user requirements we grouped largely into these six categories. Case recognition, the importance of notifiable diseases where there are conditions that we know we're interested in, that we need a system that allows us timely recognition and sharing of information around those. So that brings into play the national notifiable disease surveillance systems and potentially other specific cases that we may add over time as necessary to be recognized, particularly outside the infectious disease realm where we haven't got case reporting so readily embedded. But also cluster recognition, acknowledging that there are conditions that we would not put under surveillance on a case-by-case basis due to the potential volume and the varied reasons why those conditions might occur in the health system, but that seeing volume fluctuations might be important to early recognition of exposures that would be important for us to respond to in public health. But acknowledging that in these two areas we're talking about detection, that that's really just a piece of the broader needs of this system. We need to be able to validate signals, and the system should support public health to do that validation step, and additionally to do the event characterization. So this is where we see surveillance seamlessly connected to investigation, and how we support the tools and the national activities behind event characterization. That notification and communication are integrally related to this, that it's information sharing that's an exchange that's an important part of this, and having the understanding, the rules and algorithms for supporting that. And that quality control and improvement is also an important part of a national capability. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to Pam. Dr. Diaz has been working really 25% time that comes above her 100% time in her work with the Division of Bioterrorism Preparedness and Emergency Response. And we thank her greatly for this. And our special thanks to Aaron Fleischauer, who moved to North Carolina recently as a career EPI field officer. We were sad to lose him, but glad to have another advocate out in state and local public health working on surveillance and biosurveillance issues. So Pam, please.
Thanks very much, and good afternoon, everyone. So if you have any issues, Aaron's email address is I'm going to give you just an overview of some work that we've been doing, and as Dan said, Aaron led this process in trying to describe biosurveillance in the context of HSPD 21. The first thing we wanted to do was develop an understanding of where we are, to really understand and assess our current biosurveillance capability. If we don't know where we are, how could we know where we want to go? And as Dan mentioned, the HSPD 21 defined biosurveillance in specific terms. And the first thing we did was sit with a group of internal and external stakeholders and really work through that to get a better understanding of what does that really mean to us. And what we wanted to do was really refine the scope and the definition in meaningful terms for us. So our first objective was a process that did engage those stakeholders to trying to define what the current capability is and for that national strategy. The refined definition of biosurveillance is, as it is described here, it's the collection and integration of timely health-related information for public health action. And as Dan mentioned, its scope is all hazards of public health significance. This definition is consistent with notification requirements and international health regulations, and is consistent with some work that's been done internationally as well. So the biosurveillance capability in very general terms is a function of public health surveillance systems, both structured surveillance systems and programs and unstructured information sharing, monitoring, and communications and reporting. It's the use of non-public health information sources and information generated from epidemiologic investigations. It's highly dependent on a skilled workforce. And this capability is distributed across local and state jurisdictions, supported and complemented at the federal level. In trying to get a broad strokes vision and understanding of where we are with our biosurveillance capability, we first set out with these methods. And the methods that were used were to broadly characterize the sources of biosurveillance information. Again, very broadly characterize them and inventory those systems and other information sources to describe the current workforce needs for operating and maintaining these systems, and characterize the categories of information sources with regards to their timeliness, their representativeness, information quality and usefulness and sustainability, and then to describe current high-level limitations in information access and sharing. So those were the methods that we started out with in this description. We developed these categories, and these biosurveillance information sources were categorized really in an effort to estimate the current capability at all levels of the public health system without really inventorying specifically and describing individual systems and attributes in detail. These categories of information sources included the pre-exposure, exposure-based systems, pre-diagnostic, diagnostic, and pathogen discovery and mortality. So systems were categorized across these broad strokes areas. Pre-exposure information sources included intelligence sources that might signal, for instance, potential events or exposures to human, animal, and plant health. The exposure-based systems included the surveillance, monitoring, and measuring of contaminants, both natural or man-made events in the environment, or disease or agents in other species. Pre-diagnostic sources included surveillance and information contained in human health-related behaviors and health events that preclude diagnosis and laboratory confirmation. Diagnostic categories included information that was related to the reporting of clinical and laboratory diagnosed or confirmed events, acute human health events. And these categories are non-mutually exclusive, and their meaning of these surveillance systems as a whole defined our biosurveillance capability. So what results did we find when we really looked at the different types of surveillance systems that we have at the federal, state, and local level? Is that we were able to garner responses very quickly from 15 states and local health departments, from our work group members that Dr. Sossin described, from the Departments of Defense, Agriculture, Interior, and Health and Human Services. And all of the biosurveillance information sources we gathered for them were then summarized by those categories that I just described. And in the next few slides, I'm just going to review some of the methods that were distributed across these designated categories. The next few slides are relatively busy, and they'll be posted on the FIN website for your further perusal in the future. What we are going to do is look at these systems, though, is in regards to their timeliness, their quality of information, their representatives and coverage of the surveillance system. So just starting with exposure-based methods, those that was defined as surveillance, monitoring, and measuring of contaminants, naturally or man-made events. In terms of those kinds of systems, examples of these would be animal disease surveillance, for instance, dead bird surveillance for West Nile virus or some other disease, or environmental monitoring like BioWatch or BDS, which you may be familiar with, poison control center data. These kinds of exposure-based methods, in terms of their timeliness, it varies very widely, but most rely on further laboratory testing of specimens and of those systems. Their information quality and accuracy is such that detection of potential and acute exposures in the environment may have different probabilities of actually causing human disease. In other words, the difference between detection in the environment and effective exposure and disease in a human is unknown for many of them at the time of the signal. Their representativeness varies, but most of these are local systems. An example of a pre-diagnostic method are health indicator-based surveillance. These pre-diagnostic methods are methods used in many syndromic surveillance systems like EARS, RODS, ESSENCE, BioSense, and it's surveillance and information collected about human health-related behaviors. Again, the timeliness is generally designed, they're generally automated and relatively near real-time in many instances. Most of these use syndromic surveillance methods and require some sort of trend analysis or aberration detection methodology. Typically have a lower detection power for, again, identifying true disease cases, especially for very small, for the single case or perhaps small to medium-sized outbreaks in general. And they typically tend to monitor select populations. Diagnostic methods are essentially an example of those kinds of programs include our nationally notifiable and state reportable disease surveillance systems. And these diagnostic methods include the collection and reporting of clinical and laboratory diagnosed or confirmed acute human health outcomes. Generally, again, the timeliness here is that they're a little less timely than the automated syndromic surveillance systems, but the information quality and accuracy is where the strength of these systems lie. All cases in the community may not enter the healthcare system, though, and receive appropriate testing, so they are limited in that regard. Pathogen characterization methods. Some of these examples you may be more familiar with at the state and local level by use of PulseNet or FoodNet, but there are other examples of these types of systems. USDA FERN and CDC Emerging Infections programs use pathogen characterization methods. In general, these surveillance and information collection and reporting are based on characterization of agents in the host or the environment, such as sequencing data. Their timeliness is less than the methods that we described prior to this. They generally take more time to finish those types of specialty testing, but they're very highly specific to those agents in the host and the environment and provide very critical information for determining public health response. Many of you at state and local level have probably had the experience of working on outbreaks of E. coli 0157 or outbreaks of Salmonella, of which you couldn't have really been successful in determining the actual cause of the outbreak without some of these pathogen characterization type methods because of the background incidence of disease in your jurisdictions. Their representativeness and coverage, many of these systems involve surveillance networks of varying geographic representation. Some of the national foodborne outbreak events that we've had recently are good examples of the use of these types of systems. And finally, mortality-based methods. These methods generally are surveillance methods for reporting of human death events. Again, their timeliness is that they require frequently specimen testing and reports of human deaths that in generally aren't as timely. The information quality varies on the detection power. So for instance, pneumonia and influenza death reports are somewhat nonspecific, but do provide us with a very good estimate of the PNI deaths after and during a given influenza season. Their representativeness and coverage varies, but they are critical type systems during public health events of concern without an identified cause. So being able to identify clusters of unexplained deaths as an example, and some of those programs are elicited here. This is busy. I'm not asking you to be able to read this at all, but what I wanted to give you a feel for is what we did with the information that was provided by those states and those partners that provided information about their surveillance systems. And essentially, this is just a snapshot of one of the types of tables that we constructed looking at surveillance capabilities at varying levels of government, state and local, and at the federal level. And the importance of this is to recognize that our surveillance capabilities are quite vast at the state and local and at the federal level, and that we have lots of surveillance ability in many areas and across all of these categories, from exposure through pathogen discovery and mortality. With that in mind, wanted to just spend just a couple of moments speaking to you about some of the other areas that we looked at with regards to the current state of our biosurveillance capability. Again, if you remember that slide that I showed that showed all the concentric circles, one of the areas was the workforce, and in particular, the ability to conduct the work of surveillance. CSTE, at the request of CDC, conducted a needs assessment for an outbreak data management system that was completed in February of 07. And 50 of out of 50 states responded, and 6 out of 11 large urban areas as well. The CSTE needs assessment found that actually most jurisdictions, despite the breadth of surveillance capability that we just looked at in that one concentric circle, that most states did not, or jurisdiction did not feel fully prepared to manage data about complex outbreaks. Primary biosurveillance workforce needs, you've heard about some of them already today, elucidated at some of the workshop participants and some of the discussions, but epidemiologists, which includes all public health disciplines and job categories, as well as public health informaticians and laboratorians. Those three areas make up the public health workforce triad, and in 2006, CSTE also did a national assessment of epidemiologic capability in public health. And respondents at that time identified that there were currently 2,502 epidemiologists working in public health at state and local level, compared with 2,580 in 2004, the number having decreased just in those 3 years. And it's estimated that 34% more epidemiologists are needed to carry out our essential functions, and that there's a nationwide shortage of public health informaticians. Public health and clinical laboratories face tremendous shortages of trained and qualified employees at all levels of operations, including leadership. Finally, respondents then to this initial and very rapid assessment of our current state of biosurveillance capabilities suggest and emphasized a diversity of surveillance and investigation capabilities spanning subject matter areas and all levels of government. Improve the quality and appropriate use of novel real-time electronic methods is needed. We need to improve the timeliness of well-established surveillance systems, determine appropriate methods for integration, and address our workforce concerns with plans for this nationwide biosurveillance investment. There are opportunities that came from this very quick snapshot in time of our biosurveillance capability, developing strategies for electronic health information exchange, supporting electronic laboratory information exchange and reporting, and investigating surveillance integration methodologies and best practices, as well as supporting workforce development. And with that initial assessment, we then moved in the biosurveillance coordination unit to further elucidating priorities and strategies for the future. So I'm going to turn this back to Dr. Sawson, and he can elucidate those.
Thank you, Pam. So one of the things I forgot to mention to you is that we did make that report publicly available. We don't have a website for it, but if you send a request either after the meeting to me with your business card or whatever, we'll get it out to you, or send dsosin@cdc.gov, pretty easy. We're happy to send that to you. Keep in mind, however, in the next month, we're trying to turn around the comments that we've been receiving over the last 3 months to create a new version. Our next milestone is by the end of October to have a new version of the draft national strategy for biosurveillance for human health that really represents version 2008, with the expectation that each year now, with a number of working groups and now an engaged advisory subcommittee, that we will be making modifications, doing deeper research into critical areas as defined by these groups to enhance and improve that plan. But what we have done in this initial draft is highlight six areas for further development, priority areas where in all of this listening, both through the data gathering effort that Pam described, these meetings that we've been holding and going out and talking about what we were doing in various forums, we came back with some very strong support for drilling down and improvement in these six areas. I will speak very briefly to what's entailed in these areas, and then we're going to focus initially on laboratory excellence and information exchange to have a conversation with you about some of those best practices and input and advice and how we're looking at what we're calling drill down to actually get more specific about what the short-term and perhaps medium-term, longer-term opportunities and needs are in each of these different areas. So electronic health information exchange, that's a lot of what this meeting's about. I don't think there's anything new to tell you there than what our interests are. At CDC, this plays out in many ways in the new vision for BioSense, as really that connection between clinical medicine and public health through the standards and the systems and information exchange requirements that get laid out, privacy, security, all of those different issues that are being discussed during this week at the FIN conference. Clearly, a lot of opportunities to improve short-term and long-term our biosurveillance capability. Over and again, we heard, especially from our state and local partners, that electronic laboratory reporting or electronic lab information exchange was a critical opportunity, one of those areas where if we had invested or you know began to invest heavily in, we could really take a giant step forward in our biosurveillance capability. Some interest in unstructured data, largely in the international environment. This has proved through GFIN and ProMed and others, systems that are trolling the internet and unstructured, the stories that are out on the internet in a structured way to identify potential human health threats and outbreaks. That we need to look nationally as well at what those opportunities are. For example, we've heard from our environmental health folks that improvements in our recognition of unintentional releases of chemical and toxic exposures, that we could utilize unstructured data more effectively and more timely, and that this is an area that needs more exploration, more on the research and development side than perhaps some of the others which are more heavily implementation. Integrated biosurveillance information. You've probably heard the term biofusion, an effort within the agency at CDC to make better use of the information that exists today. How do we pull the information that's in people's heads, that's in people's different databases, that's secluded in silos, and bring it together for more effective application for rapid public health decision making? We see that it's not just a CDC need, obviously, and therefore label the function broadly as integrated biosurveillance information. Having this international connectivity as appropriate, we feel it's pretty much appropriate all the time that we think globally and not just domestically. And so how we look at global disease detection and connectivity, again, CDC has a program that's actually called Global Disease Detection, GDD, but this is really intended to be a function and look at how we as a nation address global connectivity and sharing of health relevant information, human health relevant information. And then of course that big 500 pound gorilla in the room, the workforce. How do we look differently at the workforce, at meeting the workforce needs? And what are some of the impediments that we might address short-term and longer-term? So if we have time, we'll jump into more of these topics, but we really wanted to spend a conversation with you for the bulk of the time here. And one of these areas, again, that we've been hearing loud and clear, the laboratory information exchange is the place we wanted to start that conversation. And Pam is going to help walk you through that when we find the right place. Should I give you the mic or my tag?
Okay. Before we start, so what we'd like to do is spend the next 45 minutes plus the rest of this session having a conversation with you about some of these areas. And I was going to ask Curtis, our chair, Do you know, is this being recorded or somewhere that we can, so I want to make sure that as we talk, I don't want to be writing, and I want to, and that. Okay, very good. So we'll do that as well. One of the areas that in going through that whole capability assessment we found kept coming up was electronic health information exchange. Some people describe it as electronic laboratory reporting, various other keywords given to it, but in recent years, automated methods for collecting and analyzing this data has been introduced with varying quality and usefulness. But electronic methods for managing, sharing notifiable case reports and laboratory results have not been effectively implemented nationwide. And this was a quote that came out of the initial draft strategy that Dr. Sossin mentioned that is available at your request. Now, this slide is where we'd like to use this as a jumping off point to talk with you. And this is the result of several discussions internally at CDC related to our understanding and our cross-cultural and cross-programmatic understanding of various lines of laboratory messaging and also test ordering. And there are several lines and different colors up here. Suffice it to say that what the flavor here is that there's CDC lab to CDC lab needs, sharing samples and results and information. There's state lab to CDC lab needs, obviously state lab needs, and to state EPI. And at the bottom, we've added clinical labs to represent not only clinical labs at the hospital level, but also some of the large laboratories and other independent labs, and that information needs to flow from those labs to state labs and then also to state EPIs. Ignoring some of the specifics and details here, what we were trying to get at was the difference between test ordering and essentially results sharing versus reporting or messaging for reporting of disease, for instance, with nationally notifiable diseases. And I think where we've had some discussion in taking this out to partners is, you know, asking, getting a better feel for what is implemented at the state and local level, where some of the challenges are, or perhaps best practices might exist that would help flesh this out in terms of getting a picture of what's needed for laboratory sharing of laboratory information and exchange. So I'd like to open the floor for discussion and perhaps prompt you with a question. Have we missed really any critical information pathways or directions in this?
Can I just make one statement? What you see here is a very CDC-centric thing.
Right.
It's not intended, our discussion is not intended to be CDC-centric, but we've struggled big time within the agency to get an appropriate investment strategy where we might pick up one of those arrows and say, well, we just invested for 3 years in that arrow, why don't we have the exchange of information? And it's the acknowledgement that there are a lot of different groups that need to be together, and you need to look at the whole picture. So this conversation about what are the nodes and are there different functions for different nodes is really intended to have us have a more comprehensive view where we can lay out an investment strategy that doesn't assume that if we invest in one place, we're going to fix the whole problem. And helps us with a better investment strategy. So don't think CDC, even though you see CDC up there.
Right.
Don't think, oh, this is just the state, not the local. That's not the intention here. Don't think, well, we've lumped all the clinical labs and there's really a lot of variation here. Where the variation is unique and important to bring out, please bring that out for us. But this was a simplified effort to start to have a conversation initially in the agency and now more broadly about what are the functions and roles and the stakeholders that need to be at the table at the same time to actually crack this nut.
Right. Yes.
Could I ask you to back up a second, if I try to understand the context of what you're asking us? You showed us a slide earlier of a survey that you did to look at preparedness of the 55 jurisdictions, 60% of which said that they were somewhat prepared. So is this the area where they felt that they weren't prepared? Is that the context that we're looking at here?
Essentially, that is correct. He's asking, based upon what we presented, are we looking at this from the perspective of this was a gap or an area that states and locals and others at the federal level have identified? And essentially, yes, that this particular topic of sharing electronic laboratory information at all levels kept coming up as a priority and as an area where there's been progress in, but not progress to the satisfaction of each of those. So yes, we'd like you to look at this from that perspective and help us describe it. Unfortunately, there's not another mic.
She'll need to,
if you'd like to.
You want to come up, Ray?
Sure.
Come up far enough to reach the microphone.
That sounds great.
Sorry. Well, the question, a couple of questions I have is, in terms of the volume of data flow, I think there's, in terms of reportable diseases, there's a lot more volume of data flow from clinical labs to the state EPI, which is a line you don't have marked here. Or it's maybe there, but it's very faint. Well, it needs to be, it's faint enough that I certainly couldn't see it back there. I can't even see it from up here. So. But that's the high volume of data flow. There are some data that flows from clinical labs and to the state lab for confirmatory tests such as salmonella or a few other diseases, but the vast majority of things are going from clinical lab to the electronic reporting system, which is really usually based in the state EPI, I have the impression. The other question is, in our public health organizations, how many people are there who actually have experience working in clinical laboratories? If we say our idea is to try to gather the data, the clinical laboratories that are producing indicative of disease, well, do we have the medical technologists? Do we have the clinical pathologists working in our organizations?
Do you have an answer to that?
No. I know some do.
Richard?
I wanted to point out something that I pointed out last time I looked at this, and it is a good feature of this graph. There are three colors of lab messages on here, and that's a good thing because they each have different standards and different structures. Okay, there's the LRN messaging, which is in green. There's the test order and result messaging, which is the domain that APHL is working on with their FLIP with CDC with the FLIP project. And there's the FIN lab result messaging that goes from laboratories to epidemiology departments. And each of those is slightly different from each of the other two. Now, the good thing is that the graphic represents that. The part that hopefully the laboratory community practice will work on is, do we really need three different messages?
That's a very good point, and I think that's what we want to have a conversation with. Are there priorities that you see in these areas that, or is this the end state of messaging throughout these areas? We spared you showing you what we started with. What we started with was much more complex than this in terms of lines and going from various places. And we said, well, we've got to simplify this. This is the current state of simplicity. Now, you raised the point, someone raised the point that they were concerned because most of the messaging goes from clinical labs to state EPIs, per se. We haven't used lines here to represent size or numbers. of messages. Is that the next step in terms of putting some priority to this? Scott?
I just wanted to, I know this is an older slide, and we have talked about this diagram, I think, at a meeting before that you went into California. And I was sort of raising the question that potentially there's another box there, which is the clinical community, which lies right next to the clinical labs, meaning the physician may get the laboratory results back, and then it may be reported to the state entity from the clinical office as opposed to the lab.
Right, and we didn't put that on here yet because we wanted to do some more vetting and talking about that, because that is a really important point. There is, and part of it's timing in terms of adding on, but Scott's raised the question of, you know, right next to that clinical lab, should we have the clinician, essentially, who may receive reports and then send those to the state epi or to the local health?
And the other point is there's a question mark by the NEDS line, which is a question of whether it's
bidirectional, correct.
We discussed that because of the validation issues, it is bidirectional.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So how about a takeoff on Richard's question of, do we need three different sets of standards, and do we need to look at that differently? I mean, clearly, within our agency, we have, you know, the laboratorians who you know, carry pieces of paper between the different specialty laboratories and feel that they have very special lab information system needs and very special standards for how they characterize their tests, et cetera. And you know, the question is, do we serve those needs better by bringing them all together to create one common structure? How does it happen in LA?
Well, I believe that in the longer term, we need to have one set of standards that can be inclusive of all needs. What tends to happen is every little group builds their own standard, and then and says, "Oh, we're very happy with this."
For those in the back, in case you haven't heard, correct me if I misstate what you said, but I think what was described is that the goal would be to have one set of standards across all of these, and yet what typically happens is that each group sort of gets together, creates their own standards for their particular use, and then implements them sometimes in lieu of other groups that are also working on standards. Richard, not to put you on the spot, but you brought up an issue related to some of the architecture that's being developed for laboratory messaging, the read not, or report not read architecture, and your concerns about how that might serve one group but not serve another. Could you go into that a little more?
I'll say a little bit, but there are 50 people in this room who can do this better than I can. I gather, although I'm not disposed to it, that in the FLIP project, the Public Health Laboratory Interoperability Project, that after a lot of expert thought, they decided that the best national model for lab-to-lab interchange, which is what FLIP is about, of orders and results, was a set of regional or a national route-not-read servers, where results would go from a laboratory to a server, would not be read, but would be routed to the appropriate other laboratory that was the destination. And with an architecture where every node, every lab is both a sender and a receiver, that apparently was the best, most scalable architecture. I'll accept that that was well thought through and that was correct. I have no basis for saying otherwise. The problem, as a state health department epidemiologist, I'm looking at a somewhat different problem, which is the one where large numbers of laboratories need to report to just a few epidemiology departments. Which is a different problem in terms of select graph theory than is the lab-to-lab interchange, I think. And so it's not clear to me whether that solution, the route-not-read solution with regional routers or a national router, which is appropriate for lab-to-lab transmission, is necessarily appropriate for lab to state health department epidemiology transmission? That was the question I was raising. This is a great group. I have this, I'm sure there's somebody here who studied this in graduate school and knows exactly what the answer is.
Raise your hand if you'd like to make a follow-up comment. I mean, these are some of the challenges and difficulties. I want to focus a little bit more on that clinical. Yes, go ahead.
I wonder if I can take a shot at that.
Please.
You want to do it with the mic?
Why don't you do it with the mic?
Yeah, okay.
Because I'm not sure if you take a shot if I can really.
First, everybody here seems to know everybody else. But you don't know me because I'm new to this. But I'm a technical guy. a very technical guy concerned with messaging on an internet scale. And I will tell you the de facto answer, unless proven otherwise in rigorous testing, is that when you need to exchange data from place A to place B, then the solution that will work and that will scale and that will be secure and will be extensible long into the future is plain old HTTP. Hub and spoke messaging models and other messaging models you might have heard of, such as SOAP and friend Wisdle and so on, are simply likely to be places where you dump a lot of time, you dump a lot of money, and come out 3 years later saying, I wonder what happened to all my time and my money. So I will recommend to the group that as you investigate technology solutions for messaging, that you eschew things like XML schema, that you don't spend a lot of time on non-HTTP messaging models unless you're in a very, very, very tightly controlled environment where you control every single endpoint that's part of the messaging system, which of course is not the case given that.
Thank you. Any comments in response to that? Thoughts? Dan?
Use this not as a forum to make a technical comment about this, but to give you a sense of what we're trying to do in this biosurveillance coordination effort is to create the conversation that takes us out of the silos, that creates some momentum and some pressure to get out of your comfort zone. That, you know, a lot of those CDC labs are very comfortable with where they're at because they're doing the kind of research and, you know, have the recognition or whatever it is that they're getting out of managing their labs. And by bringing this into an open forum about what we need and how we have to share, there is a collective pressure which they feel and they respond to, as many of the other nodes will as well, that we all want to be a part of something more effective and more important. And so what we're trying to do in this biosurveillance coordination effort is to create the platform, create the environment where we can start to have these conversations and push towards the places where it's appropriate to have common. If these three should go away and we should have, you know, a common set of standards, well, what are those and how much do we push if there's a, you know, broad consensus to do that? So your engagement, whether it's here or whether it's in other ways, helps us build the momentum that's necessary to bring, you know, collective pressure to ourselves to reach the kind of standards we need for near real-time sharing of critical information for health and health security.
Yes. Those are other labs at the federal level that are working on some information through an integrated consortium of laboratory networks. They call it the ICLN, which is a steering committee across those different networks, FERN, EPA, et cetera, to try and solve some of these issues at the federal level as well.
So,
So, you know, whether these are really CDC EPI or CDC program, CDC lab, or whether it's federal program, federal lab, state, local program, I think, you know, ultimately we want to make this more universal and consider where there are common needs and interests that allow for that information sharing. And you're absolutely right. We want this to be looking at all the federal state that has to do with human health. Now, a lot of agencies feel that some of their information may be relevant to human health. Other of it, or maybe all of it, is not relevant to human health, and they shouldn't be constrained by what we're doing around human health. And, you know, so it's bringing them to the table in a way where there's common goals and interests, you know, what is the value proposition for them to be at the table and be a part of something that's bigger, that's maybe funded in a collective way. So our interest is there. VA is a part of the federal interagency work group. FDA is a part of that interagency work group. EPA is a part of that group. But right now they're sort of sitting back thinking largely that this is a CDC problem. And they're going to watch and see how effective CDC is at least getting its own constituency and community together, and how we are really building more momentum that makes it worth their while to come to the table. We need everybody helping to build that momentum to bring them to the table.
Yes.
They don't see where they fit on here because they feed multiple as they feed up and down. So a simplified version of this, but when it comes to the messages, it's like you, Dr. Aller said, some group of people said, we're going to solve this one problem like flip and do a really good job at it. Well, what we're having now is we have like 15 different messaging systems with different formats on different PCs poking holes through firewalls. If we don't address that, it'll never scale. So we have to have a common format with that flexibility, and that's why the lab should have a resilient infrastructure at the exchange model within each lab. And that's, as you know, Dan, where we've been going at our level to try to put that in place so that the same model will work for PulseNet, the same model will work for the VA where they have that flexibility, especially for the EPIs, because they don't know what they need until they need it, or they need all of it.
Well, I actually, thank you. That's a comment that I wanted to tie to something I heard this morning, where there was an expressed concern that as we move forward, that we're hearing less and less about the serving the needs of that local epidemiologist who actually has to do the case investigation and the work related to getting, you know, that case identified as a true case. Hearing that and then hearing some of the discussion here, how do we bridge the two, or how does that fit into the priority of the hierarchy as we see here? Yes.
Well, another spot there for the local health departments, which links the state lab, clinical lab, to both the local and the state health departments, that's where we should, you know, in order to improve the effectiveness and the whatever of real public health is done at the local level, that if we focused on that bottom corner there and optimize that by standardizing that area, I think we have a better return on our investment than focusing on the top and what's going on at the top.
Let me respond to that comment and also back up to Dan's comment. Anybody who shares a comment and has a view on this, we really love to get you to actually write some of this stuff down so that, you know, we can go back and actually interpret the words that you said more effectively. So I think what you make is an excellent point that each of us in the room has a perspective here of where the greatest bang for the buck is. At the same time, I would ask you at the state and local level, though, whether you're frustrated when you send a specimen to the CDC with a specific order, a test order request, and it takes a really long time to get it back, and you may get it back in a fax, or you may get it in some format that you have to then hand enter it into something else. Is fixing the state, local to clinical piece enough? Or do you need to get, you know, the other reference laboratories more effectively connected as well? Dr. Allen.
Maybe I have an atypical point of view, but it seems to me that the volume of transactions and the interactions at the state and local level are way, way greater than what we might send to CDC. Now, California, you know, we have some very sophisticated labs that do a lot locally. For a small state, that might not be the case. But for us, you know, most of what we do is the local interaction, and that's problematic.
So one of the comments that was just made is that the volume of work and interactions, at least in California, is much, the perception is much greater in that triad between the clinical labs, the local health department, state lab, than their volume of transactions with CDC and with other state labs across borders. Comment?
Yeah, let me just take off on that too. Giving a state perspective, we still have our local epis who are taking faxed information of IgM positive measles and putting it into an Excel spreadsheet. Why? Because it's faster. It's faster than waiting for the inevitable whatever format message is going to come across into their health department system to be then incorporated. It works for them. Are we trying to create something that is going to work, but for whom? Is it going to work for the local folks who are getting the call from the clinician? And I strongly advocate putting another box there for clinician. Because many times that clinician is going to call the local health department saying, what do you make of this? And that never will be an electronic message. That's going to be a verbal communication. And that's going to start a response. So is the expectation going to be to create a system for data tracking that's better than a system that currently exists? And it may be that's needed, but I definitely see that parsing data in 5 through 6 different formats, electronic format, is not the solution, whether yes or no. It's more, what do you do with the information once you get it? And that's more of a policy protocol answer. And that's what I think we have to address, rather than what flavors the message.
Yeah, thank you. And just to make sure that we're clear, because those were some very good comments about the way locals work during an urgent event and how messages come into them during an urgent event. And this does not preclude that. This really is a representation of electronic laboratory information exchange only, but it's not meant to replace nor supplant nor be inclusive of those kinds of interactions and needs.
Dan, I would say all the above is really what our interest is, though. That this piece of of the EPIs in the health departments, the programs, as it were, not being able to effectively receive and utilize the information in the most timely, efficient way is a big piece of what we hear from our EPI colleagues. But at the same time, the lab colleagues have their own issues and concerns. What we're really trying to do here is to understand that bigger picture and advocate for a system solution rather than a particular user solution. So we definitely want to address all of those. Now, at some point, we're going to have to pick priorities as to where we're going to get the biggest bang for the limited dollars we have right now and forecast out where we have to make subsequent investments. And that's a challenge. That's hard to do. But specifically to your question, yes, and the rest are the stakeholder interests need to be captured in this strategy and then prioritized.
I know there are several states that there still is not a good electronic transfer of data between state labs and state entities. We'd love to have those PFG patterns, but they're still in a spreadsheet. And that to me, is that a bang for buck that's valid to pursue?
Yeah.
It's all about how you interpret the data.
What was just also described, and that was actually a question I was going to ask all of you out there, is in that triad between clinical labs, as it's represented here, clinical labs are, let's say, clinician, state EPI, state lab. Is that well developed in your jurisdictions, or are only pieces of that developed? I see shaking heads no, but pardon? It depends, right. It depends. And as somebody pointed out, depending on the size of the local jurisdiction, you could put the local jurisdiction in those boxes as well. And it was meant initially, we recognize that there are some local jurisdictions that function very similar to states in terms of their transmittal of information and collection of data. Other comments? Yes, ma'am.
If there are enough people who got that comment, then somebody back home will be able to fully integrate it. But if I understand what you're saying, and just to make sure I can integrate it better when we do go back, the investment in sustaining these capabilities we've heard is substantial. And that there is a process of adapting to standards and sustaining standards that have to happen at the individual laboratory level and then, you know, at nodal levels. And are you speaking to the need for some process in some systematic way that supports the individual labs to apply the standards and minimize the burden of sustaining electronic lab information exchange? Dr. Aller is going to comment after you do.
I think that's part of it, and I don't know what the answer is. But the bottom line is that the labs do need to adopt the standards to minimize the amount of time that they will account between mapping information to the standard. And also there's a cost on the laboratory side. From their laboratory information management systems, it can sometimes be $20,000 for one lab to create an EOR interface. And I think we're going to see that same issue when we start getting into case reporting with clinical providers. But some way to standardize that process, and I don't know what the answer is, but we need implementation of standards at the laboratory level.
Well, speaking, putting on for a moment my hat as a laboratorian, we've been trying in laboratory medicine for at least 15 years to get our colleagues in laboratory medicine to encode their laboratory databases with LOINC and more recently with SNOMED. the challenge has been that there has not been a compelling business case for laboratories. Why should they spend the money? Why should they spend the time of their personnel to do all of this encoding in Loikens Nomad until there's more users of the data beyond, perhaps beyond public health, that require Loikens Nomad encoding? It's not likely to happen. We've even had situations where national labs have Loink encoded their entire database, then changed computers. The new computer didn't have a field for the Loink code, and they went, you know, they went 7 years backwards. So it's not an easy problem. It's a it's kind of one of those lifetime projects to get laboratories to adopt these codes. In our own local jurisdiction, what we've actually had most success with is we simply go in and tell the laboratory, please give us your whole test database, and we go off and figure out what's reportable, and Loink encode it, and we build that into our system. So, but that's, I'm sure, not practical for a lot of folks, but laboratories just simply have an awful lot on their plate, and unless something is a mandate or unless they're going to have a economic incentive to encode their databases, there is just not feasible for them.
Just a real quick comment, and I think again, this point here, we're in danger of creating a new digital divide between those that are still facts, those that don't have low-end codes, and those that are participating in the flip process and using like FinMS and the Fin BS system, and all the other people are still having to do it by hand or Excel spreadsheets, nothing against the power of Excel spreadsheets. But there has to be a way to address this based on the ability or the support of the laboratorians and the informaticians to actually support this effort. Because as certain things like this move further and further ahead, like flip, other people are still moving further and further backwards. And one of the fears of this is if we take the comment earlier on the other federal labs doing their own thing with this, we're just creating a bigger problem for
bigger divide.
That if I'm an FE, all of a sudden it's a pickup phone. That's going to be the solution. It's going to be conference calls. And we've seen that happen before. And that's just a concern with this to make sure that those resources of the smart people to actually pull this all together is critical at every level. You know, in addition to the sustaining costs for those.
All right. Maybe one more comment, and then I want to pose a couple of functional goals. You had. Oh, I'm sorry. Two more.
Our group has not specifically talked about the grid, and that technology is certainly is being explored more broadly about how we share and exchange information and establish the sharing standards around it. If you think there's something specific that comes out of that we should be addressing here as we think about what the varied needs of different stakeholders are, we'd love to hear about that. More the governance process of how you make these decisions? Yeah, okay. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I was simply going to remark on what Ray said, that in my limited experience seems to be the case. All the discussion about data formats and messaging systems is for naught if the lab simply won't do it. If they don't have the financial incentive, maybe the legislative incentive to do it, then you can come up with the best system in the world, and if they don't do it, they don't do it.
Right.
Isn't that kind of the deal breaker right there?
Sure. If you don't have the buy-in and you don't have the resources to do it, it's pie in the sky.
So you don't have the incentive to do it.
Right.
You can pass a law saying you're required to.
Right.
A number of 12 states have done that. You can cajole. Others do that.
Does that work?
Somewhat. Yeah, we've had quite a bit of progress with cajoling. And the third is you can publicly humiliate or intimidate. You know.
Another form of cajoling.
Another form of cajoling.
That's the fourth one, and you certainly can underwrite costs, and we've done a lot of that. We're fortunate we've been able to do that.
Yes.
This may be naive, but with the emergence of health information exchange, where there is a reason to have your results understood by somebody other than a proprietary partner, isn't the business case emerging that will make it worthwhile for them to do it?
Maybe.
Right? Maybe. We haven't seen this go to scale sufficiently to demonstrate that incentive is what's driving it.
That there's cost effectiveness. Yeah.
A lot of the challenges we have in setting priorities here are also on what's going to happen by virtue of the environment itself,
right?
Where things are happening independent of our efforts, and what is the added benefit of accelerating that by investing and making specific investments. I mean, that raises a good point about this particular area as well, and electronic health information exchange. What is it beyond creating the momentum around these exchanges that we could do to accelerate the development of information sharing in a standardized way?
And maybe even, I mean, I agree with your triad, I guess it was, of mechanism methods, but we tried mandating and weren't successful because it was too big a political obstacle. And I wonder if it's partly because we haven't identified the stakeholders in accomplishing that who have more clout than public health does. So they may not know they're going to need it, but they are going to need it soon.
So one, another generic kind of aspect of what we're trying to do with the coordination effort is to articulate the value proposition. I think Ray has laid out some of those. I personally believe, although we haven't demonstrated it yet, that there is actual information sharing value proposition there too. And we have to figure out in incremental ways how to make the actual return on the information they share. They're actually creating some value that's greater coming back to them. But the process has to be where we're looking at that lab or that discipline in a very directed way to be clear about what's going to drive them to support playing and playing in a useful, constructive way. And we haven't done that directly with the laboratories as yet.
Playing in a sustainable way as well. I want to wrap up here in the next few minutes and also give Dan a couple of minutes to just touch on those other priority areas, because we spent most of the time, and we could spend hours and days on this. People have for years already. We're looking for some functions or activities for success in this area, and you see laid out here a number of things that people have come up with that probably there shouldn't be any real surprises here, and yet I think actually when you talk about electronic laboratory information exchange, that area or topic is sort of the poster child for the devil's in the details, always in the details. And these five areas are areas that people have come together and said these are some activities that if we could just fix these areas, we would have some success in this. And yet we've not gone about prioritizing. We're really throwing them out there as, you know, are these areas that you feel are areas or goals, and what's missing here or what perhaps doesn't belong here?
Like CDC.
Right, like the last bullet. Yes, ma'am.
Result in the greatest benefit for the whole chain itself.
having knocked number 5 off the list, I'd like to suggest we knock number 4 off as well. And that is, if reporting of communicable diseases is legally required anyway, then using electronics to do it is also within that realm, should not require a data use agreement. And thereby, we eliminate 2 to 3 years of delay in bureaucratic organizations, both on the public health and on the hospital side.
Richard?
I want to make a plea for subtlety in the use of words, or creating precision through the word. We use the word sharing. It means a lot of different things. And the more precise we can be about what we mean by that, the better off we'll be. And I mean, just thinking about the sessions I've been to today, we've been talking about at least three different kinds of things that might be called sharing. At least three. One is the one in which an organization actively pushes data to another, and a copy of their data is moved to another organization and lives there. Another is the scenario in which, when you want information from another organization, you pull it from them, and you may keep it, you may not, but you use it for your purposes. But you don't receive all the information. You pull it when you need it. That's a second model. A third is perhaps a variation of the second, in which you get the whole data, but you don't get the whole thing. You get some kind of an extract or summary of it when you ask for it. So you get some kind of a de-identified records, or you get summary records, but you don't get the actual data themselves when you ask for it. And those are at least three different, I can think of probably 6 or 8 different variations of it. But we talk a lot about data sharing without specifying what we mean. And I think it gets us in trouble.
That's a very good point.
Do we mean all of those, though, Richard? Because no one of those models actually is sufficient for a national system.
If you're going to draw a diagram that has arrow, you need to specify what that arrow means.
Got it.
Including specifying that all of the above, if that's what you mean.
Okay. Yes.
I have one comment on the data sharing. As I started to get into this data sharing and use agreement discussion, you know, I would have people tell me public health has the laws, et cetera, that give public health access to that data. The challenge we have is that, okay, a laboratory or hospital laboratory legally has that responsibility to do the reporting, but if we're interjecting an intermediary between which the region health and those organizations, they have established a trusted partner relationship with their constituent hospitals, physicians, et cetera. There's also a whole story related to patient consent. So even though we can say we have the right to that data, in order to establish that trusted partner relationship as well, we need to articulate in the data sharing agreement exactly what the data is that we're going to have access to and what we intend to do with that data, and any potential be sharing in that data as well. We need to be aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
I would just like to echo that. I think while we may not need data sharing and use agreements, I think we should want them, because agreements are how we establish trust, and making them explicit, I think, is a better way, echoing what Richard said, to make sure everybody understands what we mean and what trust we're seeking.
And building on the previous 4 speakers, but also answering Ray's thing about the not being required, if you don't need the data sharing agreement, you're required to report the information. Having been a part of 2 massive failures trying to do this, so I know what not to do, there's a difference between data and information. And that needs to be clearly specified, like you said, as part of that agreement. Because sometimes they don't want the data, they just want information, positive, negative, potentially. The other thing is, to get what Richard said, is the context, instead of trying to predefine some presets, you might start with 3, but the context under which the data would be used, the context in which public describe how the data or information will be used or even not accessible. That, the investment in that will help get rid of a lot of things and also for people planning on how much it's going to cost to implement.
Dan, is that a context as in an EG example, or is that a context and this is specifically the only ways that we will use and receive this
information? Context.
Because it's very challenging, as you know, to specify all of the different ways in the specific context and scenarios that you might need different types of specific information.
I recognize that.
But you need that, is what you're saying.
We need that, and it can't be, and it needs to be defined according to the situation as it goes forward. Now, right now it might be for normal public health use. Okay? For most, that will get things through, but the other one, to get to what Ray said about it's not being required all the time. We've had certain labs that said, we don't want to do a data sharing agreement, we don't need one. But the problem is, if I then have that data, and that person was, is Ray still here?
Yeah,
on a plane in LA, and I remember that landed in Boston, and we needed to get a lab result from Boston back to LA. Well, they have different sets of what statutory reporting. So, you know, it all of a sudden is back to the phone again. But it's dangerous to do situational context. But that has to be at least articulated somewhere in the process, because as soon as you start evacuating people, moving them across state boundaries, the laws, you know, the federated states, the models change.
Yeah, great. Well, I want to thank everybody for their engagement, their patience with this session, with the ongoing effort that we're struggling through to put these issues on the table, pick good strategies for the short term, start to think forward in the midterm and longer term, and evolve a comprehensive strategy as best we can to address these issues. What I hope this has done is piqued your interest to jump on the bandwagon and start to play with us a little bit more. This isn't going to end by the end of this calendar year, much less in the next couple of years. But what we hope to do is to have that governance and have a structure and an environment in which we can continue to evolve and pick the best practices and pick the activities that are ready to go to scale and start to figure out how to take them to scale, et cetera. We can only do that through a really big tent in all of your active engagement. So thank you for being here now, and more importantly, thank you for going forward your active engagement.
And where do we find this conversation taking place electronically?
If anybody wants to express their interest in ongoing participation, dsosin@cdc.gov, and I'll be happy to follow up with you, share where we're at, and figure out what's the right mechanism to play.
But there's no public mailing list?
There are a variety of different lists and groups that we've created, and it'll take a little bit of figuring out which is the right one and the right frequency of activity that you'd like to participate in. But this is a very much an open activity. Apologize for not having that as a slide, work in progress, but again, thanks for your engagement and your patience.